Today, we'll talk about the shopping season, which eventually morphs into returns season. And we have a story about one of the original influencers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, I'm Kristen Schwab, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 24th of November. Thanks for being here. This is a big week for retail, so of course, we're going to talk about that. But we're also going to get into what this big retail week might tell us about what's happening in the economy and how people are feeling about it. To sort out the details, we have Heather Long at The Washington Post and Jordan Holman at The New York Times. Hi, you two.
Hi, Kristen.
Hey.
So, Jordan, I want to start with you and Black Friday. It's technically today, but I feel like I've been seeing Black Friday branded sales for days now. What does that tell us about how retailers are feeling?
Well, you're so right. Black Friday is so a concept at this point. You could have gotten 50% off at Macy's last weekend. You didn't have to wait today. And I think what that really shows is that retailers have known that there's been this Black Friday creep. They've created the Black Friday creep. And part of why they keep doing it is that they know that for those who are kind of on the fence about spending, a discount will help with that. And that's what they're really looking at. For those who are, you know, quote unquote, being choiceful, that's like the favorite word retail execs are using right now. They know that people will spend when there's promotions and they'll hold back when there's not. So that's why we're just seeing weeks and weeks of Black Friday deals right now.
Right. Well, I'm wondering when, you know, when all the numbers come in, how much we should lean into, Jordan, what happens this holiday season to figure out how consumers are actually feeling.
So right now, the main estimate for what retail sales will look like this season is about a 3-4% increase from last year. Black Friday and this whole weekend is less significant than it has been in past years. It doesn't have a huge pop. Usually you'll see that in the days leading up to Christmas. So you definitely should take the data set we'll see in the next few days cautiously. It does sometimes adjust. And then also people, there's a lot of people who aren't, you know, shopping for their Christmas gifts today. They're just shopping for themselves. So we do need to see a few more weeks into the season.
I may or may not be one of those people. Heather, we talk all the time about consumer spending and how it keeps going and going. And I'm wondering what, you know, this holiday season might tell us about the strength of the consumer and whether they can keep spending and for how long.
That is the number one question. It is the year of the unstoppable consumer. I mean, you sit here and every single item that we've been talking about for months, whether it's consumers are spending more than they're bringing in income, so they're clearly eating down their savings, or now they have to, a lot of people are, of course, faced with having to repay student loans again, or you name it, there's just overcome headwind after headwind after headwind this year, at least in the United States. So I think you're right. What stands out to me so far, looking at the early data, is there seems to be a bit of a shift in what people are buying. So you're seeing a strong spending on toys and apparel, and a lot of the early earnings looks from places like Dick's Sporting Goods look good. On the flip side, a lot of electronic sales don't look as strong so far. We'll see if that changes, but recent earnings from places like Best Buy and HP or from some of the home improvement stores like Lowe's look a little weaker. So I think what you're starting to see is maybe some of these smaller ticket items doing well as opposed to these larger spends, which may be an indication of a little bit more hesitation going forward. But Kristen, for me, the most important day of the week now is every Thursday when we see jobless claims and trying to get a better read on, is the labor market really turning yet or not?
Yeah, well, more on that. There are a bunch of big indicators coming out next week, including Thursday, that'll tell us maybe how consumers feel, also what's happening in the economy. What are you keeping an eye on besides those Thursday claims?
It's going to be a big week next week for sure. And so I think the other really interesting one, again, towards the end of the week, Thursday and Friday, is we've got a lot of Fed speak. And anytime you see some of the top three, the troika, as they're called in the Fed, on Friday, Fed Chair Powell speaks twice. They just added a second appearance for him next Friday. And on Thursday, the president of the New York Fed, who's sort of considered the number three person at the Fed, John Williams, will speak. Are they going to push back at this narrative that's developed in the markets that they are done, that they're done raising rates and that they could be cutting as early as March or May? And so I think everyone will be listening closely to get more of a handle on what they're thinking as well. And of course, a little bit of a snapshot on Thursday of how things looked in November with that PCE and the income data versus spending. Are people still spending more than their income is growing?
Yeah. You know, going back to the holiday spending spree, Heather, do you think the Fed keeps an eye on how much people spend for the holidays?
Oh, they definitely do. I mean, you have to, right? Consumer spending just is the bulwark of the U.S. economy right now. But again, it's this question of we're all these predictions. Everyone expects 2024 to be a slowdown. But is it kind of like you're finishing the long run, your morning run, and then you're going to walk for another mile? So a little bit slower, but still continuing to move? Or do people just grind to a halt and sort of collapse on the ground and after the run? And I think that's what no one really has a clear picture of sitting here right now. Certainly the early numbers, as Jordan was pointing out, looking at how people have been spending so far this holiday season, looks like they're not just collapsing on the ground and stopping all spending. They seem to be keeping going at a pretty good clip. But that's what everyone's trying to get a read on right now.
Okay, most important question of the wrap. Jordan, you first. Have you started your holiday shopping yet?
Okay, so I'm definitely in the category of I have bought for myself. So I have new shoes. I am thinking about what to buy for my parents and friends. So that's TBD.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Heather?
I am one of those people who's done. So I finished yesterday.
Oh my gosh.
And I guess I'm one of the, I don't know if it's my age or the pandemic or a little bit of both, but I've definitely shifted my spending much, much sooner in the year. So I guess I'm one of those people retailers are trying to lure back to the stores.
Wow. I wish you could take care of my to-do list. Right. Heather Long's at the Washington Post. Jordan Holman's at the New York Times. Thanks, you two.
Happy Friday.
A short day on Wall Street. Today, traders were feeling mixed. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A little more on that holiday spending that we were just talking about, because 'tis the season. In the 5 days between Thanksgiving and Cyber Monday, American consumers are expected to spend $37 billion online. That's 16% of Americans' total holiday spend, according to Adobe Analytics. But the thing about online shopping is it's more likely to result in a return. Companies have gotten pretty generous with return policies, with free shipping and 60-day return windows. But are those policies here to stay? Marketplace's Savannah Marr has more.
Free and relatively frictionless returns encourage us to spend online without restraint. They also eat away at corporate profits. And Tony Shiroda with the Reverse Logistics Association says retailers feel sort of stuck.
Well, the genie is out of the bottle.
He says a handful of big e-commerce players are testing the waters with shorter windows or small fees for returns. But they risk alienating customers who have lots of other options.
I would say that we're in a very experimental phase.
Says Terry Esper, a professor of logistics at The Ohio State University.
When it comes to how we are grappling with the expectations of returns versus the costs associated with managing those returns.
He says some companies are trying to prevent costly returns by giving more detailed product information up front.
even to the tune of virtual fitting rooms, providing customers with the ability to virtually try on things.
Others have started reserving cushy return policies for their loyalty program customers. But this holiday shopping season is an especially risky time for retailers to be tinkering, says Sonia Lipinski, a retail analyst with Alex Partners.
Because we're at a point where the consumer is pretty timid, and we're going into a holiday season with a lot of uncertainty.
She says consumers are pulling back, and some are seeking out favorable return policies as part of their holiday budgeting strategies. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
If you're an office worker, you probably have a preferred place to get things done. A cubicle, a coffee shop, your home office slash kitchen table. I tend to toggle between the three. Wherever it is, your favorite workspace isn't just about what it looks and feels like, but what it sounds like. Well, as more workers return to the office, some are dealing with noisy distractions they're just not used to anymore. And their employers are dealing with them too. Here's the BBC's Leanna Byrne.
Lots of companies, from Amazon to Disney to the biggest bank in America, JP Morgan Chase, are now telling their workers to get back to the office. One interior designer in Dublin who's having to start the daily commute again is Carla Chaplin.
I work 4 days in the office and 1 day from home.
She says moving from her kitchen table back to a desk in the office was hard.
We get a lot of calls from contractors and clients, and everyone's in the one space. It's very noisy, whereas from home, I suppose you kind of stick in the AirPods and it's a lot more quiet.
Dr. Esther Sternberg is an expert in architecture and psychology at the University of Arizona. She says people don't realize the impact of noise on their physical well-being.
Loud noise is stressful. It can actually harm your hearing. It can cause your blood pressure to go up.
She co-led a study which monitored almost 300 workers in federal government offices and measured their response to quiet and loud workplaces. She says it showed whilst noise could be a problem, total silence wasn't the answer.
When people were in quiet offices, their physiological well-being increased for every 10 decibels up until 50 decibels. Of sound. 45 decibels is bird song. Normal conversation is around 50 to 60 decibels.
So a moderate level of background noise is good for workers' well-being. But Dr. Sternberg says it needs to be at a consistent level for people to stay focused on their work.
You look at people working in coffee shops. They're perfectly fine. They're working, they're concentrating. Unless somebody drops a coffee cup and it crashes on the floor, it breaks through that background of white noise.
Roy Thomas, who works in international transport in Dublin, agrees he needs some noise to help him to concentrate.
I definitely don't want multiple people around me shouting down a phone, but I think not silence, because that would, I think, give me a certain level of stress.
The retail group McIlhenny's also redesigned its offices after the pandemic to reduce noise levels for staff who had spent a long time working from home. Shane Lafferty came up with the layout. He says people weren't just concerned about noise levels. They also wanted
plenty of light into the office. Some people were too cold, some people were too warm. So having that heat recovery system that we use now gives a nice balance.
He says if other employers find that balance of noise, light and heat, it will boost the health and well-being of their workers. I'm the BBC's Leanna Byrne for Marketplace.
Coming up,
this was part of something called Egyptomania, which was an infatuation with Egypt.
Haven't heard that one before, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 117 points, 0.3%, to finish at 35,390. The Nasdaq lost 15 points, 0.1%, to close at 14,250. And the S&P 500 added 2 points, less than 0.1%, to end at 4559. Let's look at some stocks related to Thanksgiving leftovers, given the holiday. Newell Brands, which owns Food Container Rubbermaid, gave back 0.25%, Reynolds Consumer Products, maker of foil and plastic wrap, swelled 0.25%, and refrigerator and freezer manufacturer Whirlpool is up 0.2%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose 4.47%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kristen Schwab. Forget Thanksgiving. That's old news. Today kicks off the holiday cookie baking season. A couple years ago, I visited baker Maddie Gartman. She lives here in the Twin Cities. She'd recently started a cookie decorating business called Garty Goodies from her home kitchen. Since then, batches of snickerdoodle, shortbread, and sugar cookies have gotten more expensive. So with the sugary season upon us, it seemed like a good time to check back in with Maddie. She joins me now. Maddie, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So the last time we talked, I came and watched you make bulk batches of cookies in your little KitchenAid mixer in your house, and you were building a TikTok studio in your basement. Are you still working out of your house? How's it all going?
Yep, still working out of the house, still making large batches of cookies in my little KitchenAid mixer. Actually, I think since then I have upgraded to a larger mixer. and then, that summer, my little studio downstairs was completed and was in business. So,
gotcha. And how has business been since then? What have been the biggest challenges in the last couple of years since we've talked?
I think as far as my cottage food business goes, one of the bigger challenges has been supply of stuff like eggs and butter. And it's just been surprising because we've never encountered shortages like we have before. And I mean, earlier this spring, the price of eggs was insane, you know, and so that's been a huge adjustment for bakers. And sales have kind of decreased in, I would say, the last year. I'd say the amount of people ordering has slowed down a lot.
So the shortages in ingredients and increase in prices, what does that mean for your business? How much people are buying and what you need to charge to sort of keep things going?
Right. So I've had to increase my prices per cookie for a couple reasons. One is because just the cost of living now is more expensive. The ingredients are more expensive. And then I've been doing this longer, so my skills have improved. So of course, then there's a smaller group of people who are purchasing my cookies. So I'm still able to make the same amount of money, but I don't have the same number of buyers, that's for sure.
Are the buyers, is it mostly for special occasions? Is it for you were doing cookie kits? Who's your customer and what are they buying?
Yeah. So when I talked to you 2 years ago, the DIY kits were so huge and it just makes sense because so many people were home. They were looking for things to do, activities that they could do with their kids. And those are still definitely in high demand. But now that I've been able to do custom orders again, because events are happening, those customers are coming back. So I'm getting all of those custom orders again for the really specialized events.
Gotcha. So you have cookie kits, custom orders. You teach decorating classes online and in person. You also have nearly a million followers on TikTok. What is the most important part of your business? What really pays the bills here?
That's a great question. What really pays the bills are those decorating classes, especially those in-person ones. And luckily, that's what I enjoy doing the most. And I found that they're still incredibly popular. So the popularity of cookie classes since I started teaching them in 2019 has stayed consistent, which is awesome.
Yeah. Well, you know, as we approach the sugariest season of the year, I have to ask, are you a big cookie eater? Do you ever get tired of eating, making, or smelling like that sugary smell of cookies?
I'm not a big cookie eater. Can you believe it? I would much rather have a bag of chips or something salty or savory. Like I'll reach for those, you know, the little pickle roll-ups, the Midwestern sushi,
yes.
You know. I'd rather have a hand. What are they called? Pickle dogs?
Pickle pinwheels.
There you go. I'd rather have a handful of those than sweets. I will rarely grab the sweets. It's probably because I'm surrounded by it all the time.
Maddie Gartman is the creator of Garty Goodies. Maddie, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
kind of doesn't matter what's happening in the economy, good, bad, inflation, whatever. There's one category, sometimes considered essential products, sometimes considered affordable luxuries, that consistently sells: cosmetics. According to the consulting firm McKinsey & Company, the global beauty industry is valued at $430 billion. And some of the category's growth is driven by beauty influencers. Zara Hank here is a journalist and the author of a new book called Eyeliner, A Cultural History. In it, Hank here describes how the eyeliner industry got a big boost from what we might call one of the original influencers, Queen Nefertiti.
So the bust of Queen Nefertiti was transported from Egypt to Berlin in the early 1900s, but it wasn't until 1923 that the media started to cover the bust when photos of it were released to the public. And then at that point, there was an almost immediate surge in interest in this elusive and stunningly attractive queen, who, according to a lot of media at the time, was incredibly exotic. I think first and foremost, what you want to keep in mind is that it is a stunningly symmetrical face, with the features being spaced out in a way that make them most attractive to the naked eye. And then speaking of the naked eye, her eye was not naked. It was lined with kohl. Kohl is the earliest iteration of eyeliner. And it was, according to most historical records, founded in ancient Egypt. So at the time that her bust was revealed, there was almost an instantaneous fascination with her in fashion magazines. And in the broader context, this was part of something called Egyptomania, which was an infatuation with Egypt. So you would see hair salons, for example, in America, have replicas of her bust in their windows. You would see fashion houses craft lines that were entirely inspired by Nefertiti. And of course, you had many women and also celebrities start to wear eyeliner. I would make the argument of her being a beauty influencer because really, 100 years ago, we're talking about 100 years of infatuation with her looks. Even though we really do not know much about Nefertiti herself, towards the end of the 1900s, there was almost a reclamation of Queen Nefertiti as an African queen of color. You had Beyoncé, who, for example, paid homage to her in Coachella. Queen Latifah has made nods to her. Lauryn Hill has made nods to her. Many people continue to wear eyeliner in the same way that Nefertiti herself did back then, which was not only to beautify herself, but also to protect against the evil eye, to protect against the glare of the sun, to treat the eyes medicinally. So really, eyeliner is still, or kohl as we know it, is still such an inherent part of our culture. And that is essentially Nefertiti's legacy living on today.
That's Zara Hank here. Her new book is titled Eyeliner, A Cultural History. This final note on the way out today, President Biden is not doing so hot with small businesses, which, by the way, make up 99% of businesses in the U.S. Biden's approval rating among small business owners has hit a new low of 30%, according to a survey by CNBC and SurveyMonkey. It's worth saying the views of the business owners surveyed are greatly influenced by their political beliefs. But regardless, maybe this whole Bidenomics thing isn't working out so well. Here's your moment of economic context in an attempt to make today less about buying and more about giving, if you're able to give. I saw this in Axios, Feeding America, a network of 200 food banks, says it's bracing for a tough holiday season. Grocery prices are high, so there are more people in need. At the same time, those high prices mean people are less likely to donate. Last year, Americans gave the lowest percentage of their disposable incomes to charity in 3 decades. Thank you to Minnesota Public Radio for hosting us today. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is vice president and general manager. And I'm Kristen Schwab. Have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday. This is APM.